and welcome to the Oxford Society for International Development's podcast series. My name is Jasmine Alexander and I'm a second year at Oxford studying archaeology and anthropology. I'm also the South America Events Officer for Oxford this term, and so I'm delighted to be joined here today with Professor Laura Rival, a Professor of Anthropology and Development at the University of Oxford. Professor Rival has conducted research that questions the way we think about the relationship between the environment and society, particularly in terms of developmental policies. Her ethnographic work with the Warani, Chachi, Makushi, and a number of other indigenous and peasant communities in Central and South America has helped her in the process of analytically contributing to various policies regarding reconciling human development and maintaining ecological diversity in the face of environmental degradation. Therefore, we hope to explore in this podcast today whether or not development policies can actually help conserve both biological and cultural diversity in South America. Hello, Professor Rival. It's a pleasure to welcome you to our podcast today.
Hello, I'm delighted to be with you as well, virtually, mind you. And I cannot wait for us all to be able to meet again sometime, hopefully soon, in the fresh air.
To provide our listeners with some background information first, I thought we might begin by talking a bit about the Huarani Indians of Amazonian Ecuador, who you have had the privilege of spending a significant amount of time with during the course of your ethnographic research. So, how might you explain the evolving concept of biocultural diversity, both in the world of academia and in the real world, particularly in the context of South America and the Huarani?
Yes, well, to start with, I think it would be interesting to give a little bit of a historical background to that very complicated term, biocultural diversity. It's a complex set of ideas. It's about the integrated perspective of life on Earth through time and space. And to really completely grasp it before we come to whether such a complex idea would make any sense to people like the Warani, I think it's good to go back to the 19th century, the very first time when the concept of ecology became something familiar to Western minds. From the very start, ecology was always about science as well as about an aesthetic movement. So ecology has got to do with the complexity of natural world as something beautiful. Throughout the 20th century, as our knowledge of diversity of forms of life on Earth increased at multiple scales, we started to realize that this diversity happens at multiple scales, from the most macro planetary diversity to the most micro small organisms in a drop of a seawater, for example, or in a mammal's gut. We realize that biological diversity is really inseparable from what we call ecology, and that it has to do with the way ecosystems work. So science started to think about ecosystems in a new way, as networks of complex interactions and interdependencies of organisms and their environment. And what happened really in the course of the 20th century is gradually becoming aware, gradually realizing that we humans were actually part of these interrelations. We were actually part of these systemic relations rather than being outsiders to it. That took a very long time, in fact. But a lot of the work that was done after the Second World War, from the 1950s onwards, really, was an awareness of how much humans were burning the libraries of life, especially through the deforestation of tropical rainforest areas, through the expansion of agriculture, and through resource extraction. So science, again, was very often coupled with an awareness of the amazing nature of these environments that were destroyed, and also of the need to have better policies so that such destructions was not seen as something necessary for human well-being, if you wish. So the international scientific research became increasingly coupled with conservation activities. And this is how you see the growth of organizations such as UNEP, IUCN, and in the 1990s, the Global Biodiversity Assessment, in 2005, the publication of the Millennium Ecological Assessment, that for the first time tried to demonstrate scientifically the coupling of ecosystem services and human well-being. And it is during that process that the notion of biocultural diversity started to develop. So what is biocultural diversity? That's a complex issue because it came as a very multifaceted awareness of the importance of cultural diversity as linguistic diversity. So an awareness that languages were disappearing very fast and that was impoverishing us as humanity. And then an awareness that regions of the world that had been marked as being hotspots of biodiversity, as having mega biodiversity, were also the areas where you had most linguistic diversity. So to recap, biocultural diversity is complex. It's a problematic concept, but it is something that allows us to examine conservation and the values of conservation. So that brings me to the Warani. Different cultures and peoples perceive and appreciate biodiversity in different ways. That is maybe something that is quite alien to the way the Warani think about their own environment. Their own cosmology are not based on this idea of an intricate world of nature in which they are both in and outside, if you wish. However, this initial focus allowed me to really focus on what was so different in their approach to the forest when compared to other indigenous communities living around them. They were much more mobile, if you wish. They were much more involved in hunting and gathering, and they didn't like anything relating to agriculture very much. And this is what I try to understand, why this distinctiveness of their culture, of their love of mobility, of their love of certain landscapes in the forest. Now, why did they love being on the ridges, for example, away from the big rivers? Why didn't they like elaborate horticulture as some of their neighbors? Why did they prefer to hunt birds and monkeys, and they didn't really want to hunt tapirs, capybaras, or river-loving rodents? Why did their view of the forest historically was cyclical in a way? Why did they always try to find signs of past inhabitation in the forest and let themselves be guided by these markers in the forest, and on and on and on? So I focused on how their culture was different from other cultures, tropical rainforest cultures of the Amazon, to slowly moving into trying to understand how their knowledge of the forest was both very useful to a scientific ecological understanding of the mega diversity of upper Amazon, but also fully grasping the limits perhaps of looking at it purely from that perspective, because it needed to be accompanied in more, how can I say, a greater appreciation of their cosmological understanding of that world as well.
Thank you. That was really interesting theoretical background to the situation. So now that we understand a bit more about the Warani and their relationship with their environment, how would you describe the challenges from a sociocultural and political perspective that they've had to face as a result of Ecuador's position in the global oil economy?
Right. First, I would like to suggest that Ecuador is not as significant an oil producer as it may appear. These oil fields, especially the ones that were developed when I was a student on the Warani, in the Warani territory, on the other side of the large river, the Napo River, that separates the light oil fields in the north from the very heavy crude fields in the south. You know, there is a lot of questioning as whether they are economically very viable. And we'll come back to that, if you wish, in a minute. But that's an important thing to say. It's important to remember that oil prices have gone down drastically with the pandemic, for example, and nations that depend so much on a commodity like oil have suffered economically enormously. There is also, obviously, divestment. That is also an important factor to take into consideration that has an impact on oil prices. Why divestment? Because there is an awareness that financial investment responsibility needs to align itself with the Paris Agreement of 2015. And the Oxford University itself, in its environmental sustainability strategy, does say that it must ensure that the university as an investor is part of the solution to climate change and to biodiversity loss. So all of these factors do play an important economic role. And this is why there is a large democratic debate in Ecuador. And this debate is, you know, more than a decade old now. And it has definitely accelerated recently as to what is the economic future, what is the development future of a country like Ecuador. Everybody is aware in the country that conservation is not a luxury, and that oil cannot be the only resource that the country builds its development path on. On the contrary, the country needs to go on a post-oil development path. So this is, if you wish, a challenge for the country. But it is also a challenge for us as a global community, because obviously a small country like Ecuador cannot look at its forest as ecological wealth, as an asset, as a good, as natural capital, without international cooperation. So these are some of the issues I've been trying to deal with in my more recent work. And the Guarani, as oil was coming into their territory, became more and more, if you wish, part of this debate. They are themselves political actors. They are themselves thinking of themselves as citizens of Ecuador. And they have different opinions about the future of the country, very much like other political actors do in Ecuador. But of course, oil has impacted them a very great deal in many different ways that I have described in my work. The big problem, I think, is that oil, the development of the oil infrastructure in the 1960s and the 1970s caused Ecuador to indebt itself. And those levels of indebtedness are the problem now. The debt, the original debt has been repaid many, many times. So the problem is more the debt structure of developing countries, such as small countries like Ecuador. In response to that, the Guarani have also developed a greater consciousness of the extraordinary importance of their territory for themselves and for the world and for their nation. So they talk increasingly of Monito Ome. They were not saying that when I started working with them 30 years ago. That means our land, our world, our territory. There is a greater sense of, you know, this is their place, first of all, and that they are almost essentializing their relationship to their land, if you wish, and they are thinking of themselves quite differently from this very fluid, very mobile type of population that I knew in the past, because they know that in order to make any claim, they have also to anchor themselves in this landscape much more than they used to in the past. And of course, there is much more demographic growth. There is therefore more sedentarization, many, many more settlements. And there is a diversification of relationships that different communities and different families and people and individuals within the communities develop with a myriad of different outsiders.
So from what I understand, there have been some initiatives suggested by Ecuador to protect national parks from the oil economy, such as the Yasuni ITT initiative in the 1990s. But how successfully do you think that these initiatives actually consider the rights of the indigenous people that reside in the parks?
So the Yasuni initiative is a very pioneer, very interesting proposal coming from a small developing country like Ecuador to the rest of the world, saying we need to be carbon neutral. The best way to do that is to no longer burn carbon, to no longer burn oil. And so an oil producing country may have as an option to keep this oil in the ground forever, but to get some kind of compensation from the international community in order to do that. And this compensation is thought about as a mix of different kinds of compensatory mechanisms, and in great part as a kind of debt relief, if you wish. Like, as I was saying, to relieve these developing countries from these enormous debts that have mainly to do with the enormous interest rates that emerged on top of the loans that were contracted in the 60s and the 70s. And it's also a response to the changing geopolitics in which these regions that are rich in biodiversity are both national assets, but also they are global assets. They are places where carbon sinks can be articulated as a service that a nation, a particular nation, gives to the rest of the world. So there is a great deal here. You know, a lot has happened, a lot of discussions, a lot of thinking has gone on. The proposal was pioneer, so like any pioneer project, it was too early for its time, but it was also perhaps badly designed, and we could design it much better today. And new generations of such mechanisms, if you wish, are being designed today in different places in these tropical rainforest areas. So that's one thing that I can answer on this topic. Another thing is that obviously, from the perspective of the Guarani, it has been very traumatic because for them, their territory is being refought by the national or the international community as being a national park or an ethnic reserve or a mitigation area for, you know, carbon trade-offs, or as a no man's land to protect the rights of uncontacted Indians. All of that has repercussions on their lives. So legally, the subsoil belongs to the government, and no indigenous community has the right to stop the government from developing its mineral resources. So you see, there are very complex issues with land rights, with access to resources, and all of that requires a lot of patient negotiating, a lot of pedagogy, if you wish, so that the different populations that are sharing the Ecuadorian Amazon forest can come to good agreements so that everybody can benefit from the resources of the forest, and the biodiversity in the meantime can still be protected as well. There is a great deal that anthropologists can do on those themes, because this issue of social and environmental justice, of indigenous rights, are complex. They are too often articulated at very international levels, while they need to be thought about empirically, very carefully, in every single case. And that's what anthropologists are good at. And there is not enough of that work, in my view, being done.
Yeah, so as an anthropology student myself, I find that really interesting as a way to go forward and explore. But in countries such as Ecuador, then, where biological and cultural diversity are so prominent, yet there is such limited economic or financial capital to work with, how might you suggest the government or policymakers go about constructing developmental policies in an effective yet non-destructive way?
To start with, I think it's important to think about development as something that is not what the government has to do to people. It's something that is co-produced by different actors in a kind of polycentric democratic system. This is the only way that it's going to be successful, I would say. So for that, we have to understand that one does not have to live geographically close to the natural environment for it to hold spiritual, social, and cultural values. So in the region that we call the Yasuni in Ecuador, now there are many more inhabitants than just the Guarani and the Quechua, where the other population present. Because with the oil frontier, a lot of migrants came from other parts of Ecuador in search for land, in search of jobs in the oil industry, and also a lot of migrants who were displaced from the other neighboring countries because of civil war or because of the anti-drug policy in Colombia, for example, or because of poverty in Venezuela. So it makes it a very, very complex issue where development has to do with a mosaic of different people in search for a better life. But what is very clear is that in the cities that have been developing around the oil fields in the Ecuadorian Amazon, people are thinking of themselves as the Yasuni people. Yeah, they are starting to develop these identity, that regional identity. They don't want to go back to the places where they come from. Their children feel they are part of where they are, and they do value the Yasuni as a treasure. You know, they are very proud that it is a biosphere reserve for the world. They do feel that this mega biodiversity is something that they want to be part of defending as well. So it's not just the Guarani who are part of defending that diversity. Now, the problem, of course, is how to articulate all these different communities with their different understanding of the spiritual, social, and cultural values of this environment. But I do feel that it is possible. And I do feel that the Yasuni Initiative had, in principle, some of the right understanding of how to go about to ensure that this population mosaic would come to innovate in terms of living in a mega diverse environment and continue to create more mega diversity from living in it rather than destroying it. In Peru, in regions which are as rich in biodiversity, some communities talk about being bosquecinos, and I very much love this Spanish term. It means being forest people. So being forest people means you want the forest to continue to live, and that your regional identity is as forest people, is not as people who are going to just continue to deforest to create agricultural lands. And so there is a lot of very rich thinking in the Amazon region, not just in Ecuador, around these issues. And it's not just the government that has a role to play in defining the policies.
So you mentioned Peru and how not all of the development policies must be governmental. So moving on from Ecuador specifically then, how have other sustainability enhancing programs that aim to green the economy, such as the payments for ecosystem services or various grassroots projects in Brazil, managed to address the issues of overlapping environmental conservation, poverty reduction, and economic development simultaneously?
the Semeridos was our community, land holding communities in the south of Mexico, were receiving two very different kinds of payments from the government. They were receiving conditional cash transfers as part of poverty alleviation safety nets to ensure that the children would go to school and to provide health, etc., etc. And they were receiving payments for ecosystem services to encourage them to keep the forest cover. And so through his work as an economist, he showed that there were lots of synergies between the two payments and that the government could design better policies by looking at them together. And then there are many examples of legislation for protected areas and how different levels of government, as well as the involvement, the active engaged involvement of civil society for better types of rural development policies, for better types of compensation mechanism or subsidies can be very, very helpful. I have also students who work on fair trade, for example. So when we talk about fair trade in this country, we tend to think about, oh, we're going to buy the chocolate from Ghana, for example, and pay a premium so that the producers can have a better livelihood, which is fine. But in a lot of countries in Latin America, governments are actually helping urban consumers to access products from the tropical rainforest at a premium so that you have better markets, if you wish, between rural producers and urban dwellers. And I think that's very, very important. So I can give you the example of another student of mine who also worked in Mexico. And he studied one of his coffee commodity chain upgrade to help the producers to get better prices by offering their coffee to reach students in the university in Mexico City, for example. But the roasting they did themselves, because a lot of the value added, a lot of the market value is in the roasting process. So by learning how to roast the coffee themselves, by equipping themselves with all the technology they need for doing absolutely excellent coffee themselves and selling it directly to the urban consumers in Mexico City, they were getting a much better economic return. And I think that's a much better solution than what some coffee roasters are doing in Oxford, for example. We have two new roasting companies in Oxford, which is wonderful, of course, because we have a diversity of excellent coffee now here in the city. But the roasters are here, and they are the ones who captured that value. They buy the coffee from producers all around the world, in Vietnam, in Africa, in Latin America, and they generate the value here, which is fine, of course, because they are young people and they need jobs as well, I know. But you see what I'm trying to say here. There is a lot of issues to sort in how we think economically about commodity chains and where the value is realized and how primary producers can get better prices for their products as well. I have another student from Colombia this time who's done wonderful work as well on agriculture and food systems in his country to show that if you bring the two together, you have a much better understanding of the policies that government need to articulate to benefit both urban consumers and rural producers. And his work has been very important in the peace process in the Colombian case as well.
So moving on from the more developmental side then, and to finish with a more anthropological perspective, how do you think the indigenous peoples of South America view these kinds of policies? And what kind of insight do you think they could provide to ecological restoration projects if they were given full agency in the political or economic world?
Yes, this issue of ecological restoration is a fascinating one, and there is a lot of research to be done on that, because in a place like Latin America, but it's true in Africa and in Indonesia, it's true in many tropical areas, there are millions and millions and millions of acres of degraded land that could be restored. And of course, there are many ways of restoring this land and many different visions of how to restore it. And so that's where it becomes absolutely fascinating. I do remember that, to go back to the Warani, they had some land badly damaged, you know, that could be restored. But also there was a different kind of ecological restoration to be thought about in their case, linked to sedentarization. The fact that because of all these changes I have briefly talked about earlier, how can you live a Warani life which is based on mobility, which is based on not adopting intensive agriculture, but having a intensified system, if you wish, of fruit trees and an abundance of wild plants and of animals which are wild rather than domesticated. And so I had lots of ideas on how to do that. It's something that fascinated me so much. And we had lots of conversation with my Warani friends. And I said, I know exactly how you could do it because I know your culture well enough. But I said, I don't want to tell it to you because you are the ones who've got to come up with the ideas. It's your ecological restoration project, after all. It has to be yours. But they didn't care about theirs. They were more curious about mine. They said, oh, please, please, we are dying to know. How is it that you're thinking of our vision, you know? And that is so Amazonian, you know. It's always for native Amazonians, they are always more curious about the way the other sees them. You know, this is really what they are interested in. In any case, there is a lovely doctoral student at Stanford University who has been doing this work with the Warani, documenting their ethnobiology and creating a school program for the children and the young Warani college, high school kids, that has very much this vision of reconciling their indigenous knowledge and biological science. So we will see how it goes. And there are other people who are trying to design these restoration projects in the Warani communities. My guess is that you could come with quite different Warani vision of how to restore the forest, because it's all about diversity, after all.
Yes. Well, Professor, that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. It's been incredibly interesting and insightful talking to you about the social and environmental effects of development in South America and also the various development policies in place.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you. As I hope to have shown you, there is a lot more research to be done. There are lots and lots of exciting projects and a lot of hope as well. Yes, there has been massive amounts of destruction in the last 30 years, but I think that new generations can help revert that. You know, we still have time. We can do a lot of things. And in Latin America, I see a lot of very, very positive energy, a lot of enthusiasm to revert the destruction of the past. And I hope that a lot of you at Oxford will want to join these projects.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, that sounds really interesting. And after talking to you today, I feel like you have inspired me and I would love to pursue and explore a bit more. So if our listeners would be keen to find out more about anything discussed today, do you have any recommendations for where they might find some more information?
Please go on my website, on my webpage. I gave a talk recently on Oxford Mines. You can go there as well. As I said, I gave a talk 2 years ago for Oxid on payments for ecosystem services. please read my articles, my books, and do not hesitate to contact me, laura.rival@infro.ox.ac.uk. I'm always more than happy to answer any query, any questions.
Thank you again, and to our listeners, this has been Jasmine Alexander for Oxford Society for International Development with Professor Laura Rival. I hope you have enjoyed this episode, and please join us next time for some more interesting discussions.